Online Trading Academy's core strategy is patented and is built on a timeless principle of supply and demand. Text Curly, C-U-R-L-E-Y, to 57682 and learn how you can trade stocks using this patented core strategy. Text Curly, C-U-R-L-E-Y, to 57682.
Got it. Here we go. 10:06. Bucky's Auto Service Center's Tom. Wish them a happy birthday.
Happy birthday,
Bucky. Too soon,
Bucky.
Tom. They're not celebrating their birthday yet. They're just getting practice. Getting
happy
ready.
Birthday,
hey,
Bucky.
Bucky, you're 50.
Happy
birthday. All right.
You throw me to the wolves. You ask me to do something just to jump on me. So I'm going to jump on you.
Okay. Jump on me as I dive into the news. Jump on my back. Let's go swimming together. Did you get a wedgie as a kid?
No.
Never.
No.
Around the horn. Patrick, wedgie?
Of course.
Andrew, of course.
Never.
Really? Wow, that is weird.
Okay, and you, John?
Of course, atomic wedgies.
Okay, how many did you give versus how many did you get?
I think I got more than I gave.
Okay.
Me too.
Yeah, yeah.
Atomic wedgies are the worst. Did you ever have your
underpants
ripped?
That was on the doorknob. Yes.
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 Me too.
Yes. Yes. Never recover. Yeah, physically, but never mentally. Never mentally from an atomic wedgie.
Well, I say thank God for parochial schools then.
All right, here we go. It says something about you as a person, Tom. You grew up your entire life without a wedgie.
That's right, and without giving one, though. That's what makes me such a great guy.
Seattle, Seahawks didn't have the best season. Cliff Avril has been released, they say, for physical reasons. I think he had a neck spur or something happened,
yep.
And he was questionable, but didn't play so well. I think he only played like four games or something. So the Seahawks have released
him. And then he got hurt. I mean, he didn't play well. He was hurt. So, yeah, he was out. And as he says in his long and really nicely written piece in the Tribune, he had no idea. He did not think this had anything to do with his career.
Uh-huh.
He didn't think it was going to be even season ending. Mm-hmm. He just thought, okay, at worst, the worst case scenario, he'd be out for a couple of days. He said he felt a little, you know, numbness, but you know, it went away, and he thought maybe he'd even get back in that game. It turned out that not only was that the end of his season, it was the end of his career for the foreseeable future.
So Avril looks back at the Seahawks, and he tells great stories. It's beautifully written because it's very conversational. I've met Cliff Avril before, and he's a really nice guy.
Yeah,
he flies back to Haiti and raises money for organizations. I stood there one time watching him. A bunch of Seahawks were standing off the side, and people were coming up to him. He would not turn anybody away. There were photos and autographs. He's signing, and just a patient, large, caring guy.
Yeah.
And in this piece, he walks you through what it was like to be on the plane after they won the Super Bowl. I mean, that's funny. And then he talks about how the ping pong table became the place where a lot of stuff was sorted out, that you would challenge somebody to a ping pong match, and then no matter what happened on the field or off the field, that's where the scores were settled.
Even if it was good-natured ribbing in the locker room, he says, it would always come to a head, the so-called battle of, let's duke it out on
the ping pong table.
And he says, he had come from Detroit. He says, one of my seasons in Detroit, we were 0-16. Remember that? He says, so when I came to Seattle, I was really kind of miffed because I was just seen as basically a role player. I thought of myself as a star, and it kind of it humiliated him. But he says he had never run across so many great competitive players on defense as the Seahawks had. He said it really made him up his game, and he says, and that came to the level of a ping pong table, ping pong playing as well. And he says, we were more competitive on the ping pong table than we were on the field.
Yeah,
he says it was amazing, and everybody thought they were number one, but certainly in the top five. And he said, I wouldn't claim that, but he says there was something great about that ping pong table because there was a camaraderie around that ping pong table that was unlike anything else.
Yeah,
and he makes this interesting comment. He said we played more ping pong games than you can imagine in that Super Bowl season or for those few years there. And he says, I just am realizing now that we didn't play much ping pong this past season. Now, he says, I'm not blaming it on just the fact that we weren't playing ping pong. We had lots of major injuries, season-ending injuries for a lot of players.
Mm-hmm.
But he says that was a factor that was missing, that kind of camaraderie, rally around the ping pong table, boys, and you might have a better team.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, that's a feeling I got too. I felt sort of sad.
Yeah.
But I guess that's what happens when a team begins to age and injuries start to occur, and then you have some battles going on with personalities back and forth, right?
Yeah.
And then you don't find the ping pong table to be such a place of solace as it was. He said when he first got there, he was not a very good ping pong player.
Yes.
And it's, if you're wondering who the best was, still without hesitation, it was Stephen Hauschka. Hausch Money, they said he was cold, man. I mean, he was the game.
But he doesn't. This is how competitive these guys are. He says after the first season that he was there, then they had the off season. When they came back, he says, suddenly, Earl Thomas had upped his game. He says, I don't even know how you could cheat at ping pong, but I was convinced he must have been cheating. He was like playing out of this world. And then he fessed up, Earl Thomas said, that he went out and bought a ping pong table and practiced like crazy at home to make sure that he got better. So next to Hauschka, he thought Earl Thomas proved to be the best.
Threw a little shade at Richard Sherman saying, not good, sorry, bro.
Yeah, that's right. He lists all the good people. He said, now, he's a really good player, and he's a really good player. The one guy can say, sorry, Sherman, sorry, bro. You were never it.
Let's see. The Seahawks have something to prove, just the way Pete Carroll does. Piece in the Seattle Times. By the way, let me ask you just quickly. Here we are. It is May. Are you excited about the Seahawks season?
Well, you know, it's funny. This is the first season where we have no expectations. Yeah. Like, no one expects us. We all think the Rams are going to be, you know, as good as advertised, and maybe San Francisco, that we are on the decline. Maybe we'll come in third. Mm-hmm. However, I've got to say, there is something, especially after reading Larry Stone's column, we are a bunch of nobodies again.
Yeah.
And he says there's a kind of excitement, and they say that it's palpable. The coach's excitement. Pete Carroll said, oh, my God, he was just talking to his fifth-round draft pick, Trey Flowers, who they're converting from a safety to a cornerback. And he says, he came out, he says, I just realized how much fun this is. When you're dealing with a bunch of young guys, he says, and you can instill in them the kind of fervor they're going to need and won't warn them about things. He says, you just forget how exhilarating this is. And I think it's so exhilarating for him right now because that's exactly what he didn't have these last couple of seasons because, as the player said, we've heard every one of his stories. It doesn't do anything for us. Now he gets this young, fresh-faced rookie out of Georgia or whatever, and he's eating up.
Yeah, he can tell all the stories again.
Yes.
Yeah.
So from that point of view, it's like, it'll be interesting to see about a bunch of young, hungry guys, how they'll manage to tackle the season.
Yeah, I did an auction on Saturday, and there were two tickets for a Seahawks game that was against the San Francisco 49ers.
Oh, yeah.
December.
Yeah,
two of them. And I thought, what kind of reception will Richard Sherman get when he goes on the field? That's why I tried to sell it. It sold for $1,800 for two tickets.
Okay.
And I thought that's probably about right. I think a lot of people are on the fence as to what this season will be like. I think if we show a couple of young upstart players and we start to have some wins, even I think people will be okay. They won't be happy. But I think a 50-50 season will be all right, as long as we see that we're building towards something. I think we saw a decline coming last year.
Yeah.
And without the major changes that were made, people would become really dissatisfied.
Now, I think people forget, but we were picked to make it to the Super Bowl. We were the odds-on favorite. They thought we'd lose to New England in the Super Bowl. Again, this is the bookies in Las Vegas.
Right,
That was how much expectation we had, but then we had everybody get hurt, including Sherman and Favor.
I know you tune into the Tom and Curley show for outstanding sports talk. So we're going to throw one more at you. If we haven't driven you away with our analysis of the Seahawks 2018-19 season, the Sounders end up with a one-man advantage.
Yes.
And who are they playing against?
The Columbus Crew.
Of course the Columbus Crew came to town. And Andrew was there. Patrick was there. Andrew wasn't there. Patrick was there. And at one point near the end of the game, something normally not heard on the field occurs.
The coaching staff for Columbus are
on the pitch.
Screaming for the final whistle. There is the final whistle. 0-0 it ends as Columbus plays with only 10 men after the 15th minute red card.
Okay, I couldn't hear it very well, but what was happening, Patrick?
Yeah, you couldn't hear it very well on the audio that we had. It took me by surprise. After the final whistle blew, it was very clear. People, loud boos raining down onto the field, and I've never heard that before, and I actually looked to the field to see if like somebody was getting in a fight or like arguing with the referee.
Somebody running on the field.
And it was just that we've been playing so poorly this season, and we were, again, a man up the whole time, and we weren't able to score. So it's disappointed fans booing down on the team, as most stadiums can feel when you're in this big of a slump.
Yeah, and what's astonishing about that is the Sounders, don't they still have the best fan base in the entire league?
Yeah, I mean, they're so loud.
It's actually strange. You're starting to see a couple more vacant seats at games now, I definitely start to feel that, you know, maybe the excitement around the Sounders is definitely on a low point right now.
It is weird coming from Philadelphia where people boo all the time. You know, 40-yard gain on a football field, and then the next one you fumble it, and then they boo you. Right?
Yeah.
But with the Seahawks, I remember being in a game, and I turned to Rye and said, wow, they're booing the players. Because the defense had come in, or the offense had come in, I think, went three and out like six times in a row,
right,
and they flashed up on the screen. They weighed negative 15 yards rushing, and they went a three and out, and again, just booing as they go off the field. Because I think the fans will give you a certain amount of grace, especially in Seattle. But then at some point, it's like, well, this is ridiculous. You guys really look like you don't care.
And I don't know if that, I mean, they're just responding to the product on the field, or if that's an indication that we are losing faith.
Yeah. Mm. Do you like it's better if we cheer them and they do something good and boo them when they do something bad? Is it better to have the hot and cold switch on and off?
The thing, I think it's better for the fans. I don't think it's better for the players. How's
you don't think
that?
It motivates?
Yeah.
No. Seriously. You don't think it motivates? No. Hey, we're losing the crowd.
Yeah. Let's get them back,
come
boys.
On, guys. Let's try harder. Come on. Block everybody.
I'm afraid not.
You figure this kid would have gotten at least a B on this essay, put some effort into it, because he had an advantage that no other student in the class had. It's almost like cheating, and yet in the essay ends up with a C+. It's inexcusable.
I think this is hilarious. Ian McEwan is probably the most popular and maybe the greatest living British novelist alive right now. A number of us might have known him for Atonement, was made into a movie, Amsterdam on Chesil Beach. Anyway, he is like a premier novelist, and his son, this was a few years back, he's just now fessing up to it now. A few years back, one of his books was assigned to his class. I think he was probably in high school. Mm-hmm. And he wrote an essay with the help of his dad. Now, the dad said, I didn't help write it, but I talked to him about it. I said, well, here are kind of the things you want to focus on. And his son got a C or a C+ on the essay. And so this raises the question in the author's eyes, Ian McEwan. I don't know. I'm not sure that's a good idea to recommend people analyze novels. I mean, what's exactly the point? And he says he thinks that in this case, his son's interpretation clashed with the teacher's interpretation, and so it was held against him. And he says, that's what I don't like. Authors don't like getting, you know, sort of scripted ideas. Here's what my novel's about. Here's the point of my novel. Mm-hmm. It's much broader experience than that. It's just kind of I like the irony of his own son, even with the help of his dad, can't write an essay of any significant note about his dad's own book.
But why did the teacher have, knowing that the son was in the class, it couldn't have chosen a different author?
Well, see, remember, this is a story told by the author about something that happened to his son a few years ago. And being a good writer, he probably, like you do, you know, he put a little shine on the apple.
Oh, there's nothing wrong with shine. So, you may listen to it.
We don't. I don't really know. One interesting thing about this for me is that On Chesil Beach is the latest book that is going to be turned into a movie. He decided that he was unhappy with other screenwriters doing it, so he's adapting it himself this time out. And that movie is playing in the Seattle International Film Festival, which starts in a couple of weeks.
One space between each sentence, they say, that science is proving them wrong. I have to say right now that I read the article, and all it did remind me when I was in, I don't know what grade it was, we were assigned, and we're going to type it. It was the first time we had to type an assignment,
right?
Type an essay, and turn it in. And the teacher, the nun, said to us, and I want double space.
Oh.
So I was like, double space. I guess that's between each word. So I double spaced between each word. I know. Nobody bothered to tell me double space meant between lines. I didn't know that.
Oh.
So it was really spread out.
You're having flashbacks with this story.
I was like, nobody tells you double space.
Yes.
Yeah, that it was supposed to be two pages, but when you double space, you can get six pages. Your essay. It's very tiring on the reader's eyes, though, Tom.
Well, it turns out that, and this is great because unbeknownst to us that there was an academic argument going on, I remember talking with Stephanie over at MyNorthwest.com about this. I was trained, like anybody my generation, when you learn to type, you have to take two spaces between the end of one sentence and the beginning of another.
Yes.
And yet, when it goes on the computer, They don't do that. They said, well, no, that's if you're typing, but, you know, the computer screen, you don't need that space. And so Washington Post did this, speaking of science, column all about that. What is better? Do you two-space it or single-space it? Since now almost nobody types and everybody is on a computer. So they did these studies because they say they're two really strong camps arguing one way or the other. They did all these studies. They took 60 students and they had them type things up and then they had them read their own typing. And science proved that you read, it's the smoother read is with the, if you have two spaces.
Oh.
Now, that doesn't mean that's literally going to happen, but what they said is that it doesn't have a lot of impact on things. It just speeds it up barely, and mostly it speeds it up for people that type and prefer the two spacers. For others, it's like neutral. But anyway, these are the kind of major arguments that are happening in the culture today. How many spaces do we put between sentences?
Did you get a chance to watch the Kentucky Derby?
I did.
I wonder how many people watch it. Patrick has decided to do as a favor for everybody. He has taken what is a 2 minute and 20 second race.
Uh-huh.
And we got it down to 22 seconds for you. Here we go.
All
so
right.
Everything you need to know.
They're all in line and we are ready for the start. They're off in the Kentucky Derby. And Justify had a good beginning, and they're into the stretch, and it's Justify and Mike Smith turning for home in front, coming to the wire, he's just awesome! Justify has won the Kentucky Derby!
There you go.
Yeah.
Hey!
You know, this is funny because this is the sixth time in a row, and the first time in the history of the Kentucky Derby since like 1890, that the favorites have won six races in a row. Mm-hmm. For about 20 years, the favorites always lost, and that became the story. And now we've got the story that the favorites always win. I got to tell you, it's much more exciting when the favorites don't win.
Oh, yeah. Because that's all they talk about leading up to it.
Yes, that's right.
Then they'll give you the dark horse, the one that this could be his race.
Well, the great thing is one of the dark horses was Mendelssohn, which is, they say it was an Irish horse and it just won by 18 and a half lengths in Dubai and won something in California. He was an international horse, and there was a lot of talk about that. He got bumped coming right out of the gate by somebody, and he ended up 20th out of 20 horses. Mm. So,
I like to watch those races. I didn't see the Kentucky Derby, but on mudder days like that, really rainy days, the jockey will go through, on average, 9 goggles.
Is that right?
Yeah. And that's Patrick tried to look for it. So they've got them all on.
Yeah.
And they just peel them down. They peel them down. So they're coming down around their neck.
One of the smart things, Justify was in the front for about three quarters of the race. And so when they came in, actually, the caller said, oh, look at that beautiful, clean face.
Well, I was just going to say, are you guys going to talk about the $18 bet?
Oh, yeah. How about that? So a woman places an $18 bet. And what she has to try to guess is the five, not just in that race, but five winners throughout the afternoon.
In a row. The last five races at the Kentucky Derby, you have to guess the winner. She guessed all five, including a 49-1 long shot in like the third or fourth race. She won $1.2 million on an $18 bet. The winner of the Kentucky Derby only won 1.43. She won almost as much by just putting down 18 bucks.
Yeah, but she did some work. Did they talk to her later on? I don't know how much of it was guesswork.
Yeah, the thing is that's more than guessing. You've got to. It's brilliant though, but it has to be some guess. Who's going to pick up 49-1 shot on one single bet?
I wonder how racing will change because they're thinking of getting Lasix. Lasix is the thing that stops the bleeding from occurring in the lungs, and they're thinking about stopping that because they see it as a performance-enhancing drug before the horse races.
Really?
Yeah, so the UK has eliminated Lasix. No more Lasix. But in the United States, they still allow the jockeys, they still allow the trainers to inject Lasix into the horse. So they said, this will change. This will change how the horses race. It'll change everything if they end up finding it to be abusive to the animal, as they do in the UK. We'll take a quick break. We'll come right back. Tom and Curly on Cairo Radio at 1024. Write to us at mynorthwest.com. Text as well at 98973. And finally, the story you've been waiting for, the woman that sings with her own egg.
Hey, business owners. We can get your message in front of this captive audience. Give me a call, Tina Sorensen, General Sales Manager for Cairo Radio, 206-726-6819.
All righty. Write to us at mynorthwest.com. Text as well at 98973 at 1033. In the morning, we do love to hear from you here in the Tom and Curly Show. We ran into so many of our fans, Tom, over the weekend.
You did?
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
And?
I did the best I could defend you.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's good. John, I do the same thing.
I know, Don.
I had a number of people. In fact, the people sitting next to me at the opera are Tom and Curly fans.
Were they? Yeah, how they know it was you?
I don't know. I guess they heard my voice. They asked me something, and I said, and they said, do I know you?
Oh, look at that.
And I said, yeah, I'm John Curly.
Ha, ha, ha. Good one. Let's see. Woman meets her egg and calls it mind-bending. First of all, just to clear the air, have you ever donated sperm for money? Just to clear the air.
I've never donated sperm for money.
Ever donate platelets for money?
I don't think so. Okay. Selling my own blood?
Okay.
Yes.
Just checking.
Okay. And you have done both, I take it.
I have.
Wow, really?
Desperate.
Okay, I mean,
desperate times.
So what'd you get more money for, your sperm or your blood?
Ironically, there was a little bit of both in each.
Oh, man. I've got to go. Can you take the rest of the show?
The platelet thing. There's a bunch of actors. I was 22 or whatever, living there, and a bunch of actors. And the guys, I said, man, I am really struggling.
Yeah.
And the guy's like, you know, let's all go down. We all went down to the Y or wherever it was. No, it was this place over near the Y. And you could give platelets. They gave you like $45.
I know. No, and I have no problem with that. I don't have a problem with the other either. But did you think about donating your sperm?
Yes, I did. I donated it. I mean, I figured doing it for free, I might as well get paid. And then the other part of it was, one guy said to me, you ever thought about whether or not you got a kid out there?
Well, I know. So that really is a great introduction to this particular story.
That's what I was trying to do.
But I don't even care about the story. I'm more interested in your story now.
Wow.
No. So there may be curlies swimming around the universe.
We hope so. We hope so.
How many times? I mean, you know, there are always these stories about these sperm doctors.
He didn't know what he was getting into when he asked you.
Yeah. I mean, no, I'm fascinated. I've never met anybody who's actually done this.
I would need to think about it. But I think over like a 2-year period, probably 6 times.
Okay.
All right. Anyway, there's a woman who donated an egg, Tom, which is far more complicated and more expensive, and you get paid more. Ugh, there's part of that gender inequality.
But I don't know that you – she said she donated. Now, do you use the word donate if you get paid? Because she says she donated her eggs.
I think they compensate her somehow. She just gave one away?
Yeah, well, out of the goodness of her heart, the idea is that you're willing to help other women conceive, and so you give her – so I don't know that there's any monetary compensation. But the interesting story about this is when she did that, they take her her first name, her year of birth, and then something about like her students. She's an honor student at is this Cal Berkeley that they're at?
Mm-hmm.
And she did give permission for if this egg was ever fertilized and became a human being, that person could then try to contact her. So there were legal there was legal clearance. And then son of a gun, if almost 20 years ago, she says she donated this, and then she got contacted by a 19-year-old who was indeed her offspring of a sort. And it turns out the irony to some degree, or the surprise, is that she's in the same a cappella choir that her mom was in at the very same school, unbeknownst to each other when that happened.
How long ago was this?
It says almost 20 years ago.
Oh.
Oh, so could you be the father? They apparently posted on Facebook. I assume we don't have the sound of the two of them singing together.
Yes.
Oh, my God. Let's do this.
Absolutely.
And then we want to hear you join in to see if you could be the unnamed father.
I don't know the words.
In cavalcades, and she'll take all you ever have. But I'm gonna love you.
It's me playing the piano.
Stay maybe less time.
You get $10,000.
$10,000
is what you get to donate an egg.
Is that right?
Quote, donate.
So do you think that? So you think she made $10,000? Is it boy?
No,
I
this is $10,000 today. These are today.
Okay, you just today. Go. So 20 years ago, I don't know.
I don't know. They give you $10,000, but
but you can imagine a student that could be.
Why not?
Well, I mean, why not? So that's what's interesting about this story. In addition to the kind of sweet coming together of mother and daughter, so to speak. But there, in the comment section, there were a lot of people. Some people praising her, what a generous thing, and others said, "Oh, you selfish person, you should feel, like ownership of mm-hmm. your own eggs, and that you are, you know." I mean, it's very kind of negative stuff. A lot of people feel this as philosophically objectionable.
Yeah.
You apparently didn't have any problem with that.
Well, I tell you, when you do deceive them on the application, when they ask you about other things that you may have, like basically they're trying to figure out what genetic traits you're handing down.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And I didn't tell them about the dyslexia.
Okay.
So then I figure I'm damning like a, you know, 6 or 7 kids or whatever to being dyslexic. But yeah. they'll have other strengths.
Yeah, that's right.
Hey, you can get far. You can get by very far in a neatly chiseled jaw. That's what I gave you. All right.
That's right.
You go, kids.
And in your late 50s or early 50s, even, you can get Botox to fix whatever is not working.
That's, by the way, what a scam that is. They inject the Botox into you, and then they tell you, "We'll see you again in 3 months."
Yeah.
What? So another 300, and I asked Ursa about it. Not that Ursa would ever get Botox.
No, but she's curious about yours.
Yes. So then the thing is, then that's, okay, so 3 months from now, you got to go back in, and they bang you for another 330.
Well, so it's like you fill up your car with your tank of gas. Son of a gun, I got to go again. What
like,
a ripoff.
Tom, you got to keep going. Or if you don't keep going, then your wrinkles come back. So that's how they get you.
You want permanent Botox.
Man, oh man, the woman goes, "Okay, so we're going to make an injection here and here, and I'm going to give you just to make sure that we don't get the arched eyebrow." I said, "What's the arched eyebrow?" This is just she's plunging the needle into my skull. Yeah. Making it sound a little more dramatic than it actually was. She said, "Well, sometimes sometimes you can get the arched eyebrow, that one eyebrow will go up, so you look sort of curious."
John's in a constant state of surprise these days.
I don't understand. Well, there's no parking spots.
But the good thing is, in 3 months, it'll wear out.
That's right. But do they look even?
Yeah, I didn't notice it.
Okay.
But I still see the wrinkles, too. You know, John, it would be easier. Just buy a mask.
No. By the way, Patrick's going to take pictures of it, and we're going to document it.
Yeah, each day.
Each day.
Because you say it's supposed to be
within 7 weeks. Or
seven days.
7 days.
Yeah,
I'll be unrecognizable. All right. Fast break. Come back. Tom and Curly, show right to us at
And if you know you're a son,
please,
unbeknownst to John Curly, let us know.
You'll become letter of the day. Rudy Giuliani, some people say, has lost it, Tom. He did his big tour last week, and then he appeared in just a few as he's trying to get things straightened out as to what was really happening. Did Trump know about the $130,000? Did he give the money? How did he give the money? He says he's done a pretty good job of clearing the air, although he doesn't have all the facts as of yet.
Right.
Will Rudy, question, prediction, will Rudy last till the end of May? Yes or no?
Yes.
Wow. All right, we'll come right back.
This Tom and Curly podcast is brought to you in part by Farrah.com, the way to sell your home and pay no listing commission. But there are 3 other reasons why Farrah listings are better. Everything's transparent. You get online offers and an appraisal guarantee. Discover the new way to sell your home. Go to Farrah.com, Farrah.com. Now, the Tom and Curly podcast.
Brother listens occasionally if he doesn't have a case.
Is that right? Cool.
Yeah.
Hello, brother.
He said you missed the best part of that sperm donation story, which was the fact that my roommates and I used to all go down there together, and we would try to get rooms beside one another, and then you would knock on the wall.
What, when you were finished?
No. To interrupt the other guy. And you'd say stuff like, "Who?
Hey, what are you doing in there? Hey, Matt.
And just hearing your roommate's voice put a stop to
kill
a lot of
the mood. Oh, man.
What are you doing in there, Matt?
Oh, man. Good times. Rudy Giuliani, Tom, is he's out on the circuit. He is America's mayor. And some people think he sort of has lost it. You know, he was supposed to run for, he was supposed to get Secretary of State, and he was one of the transition team guys. I saw this on Morning Joe. Apparently, some people that were in those meetings when the transition time was occurring and Rudy wanted Secretary of State, they said within 5 minutes of the meeting, Rudy's chin would be on his chest. He would be asleep. That he had, yeah.
He's in effect auditioning for a job, and he would fall asleep during the job interview.
Not just sitting around the, everybody's around the table, and the transition team was talking. The one person was at the table said, "Yeah, Rudy sort of had lost it.
Wow,
yeah, and that he would be falling asleep at these meetings, and that's might be one of the reasons they passed on him for Secretary of State." Okay, so Rudy is back. He's joined Donald Trump's team, and after last week's horrible rendition of Trump doesn't know what he, Trump knows things but doesn't know things, Rudy went on ABC over the weekend and said,
"What happens if Robert Mueller subpoenas the president? Will you comply?"
Well, we don't have to. He's the president of the United States. We can assert the same privileges other presidents have. President Clinton negotiated a deal in which he didn't admit the effectiveness of the subpoena.
But he did testify before. Yeah, but he did testify before the grand jury. Is the president willing to do that?
But only for 2.5 hours. Only with an arranged format.
So the advantage of not waiting for the subpoena is you can head it off at the pass and say, "Okay, I'll tell you what. We will talk, but I'm going to have lawyers present, and we're going to restrict the questions just to these two or three topics, and that's it." But if the subpoena comes flying in and he can't fight against the subpoena, then there's no lawyer present, and they can wide range of questions. So the question is, you have three choices, right, Tom?
Yeah.
It's speak now, wait for the subpoena, or get the subpoena and fight the subpoena.
Right, yeah. And so right now they say there's a lot of jockeying in the White House for what is the best move. The danger is, so let's say that they agree to like 2.5 hour questioning with your lawyers and all of that. That still opens up Trump to being questioned. And if you're afraid that whatever Donald Trump may say, even with the advice of his lawyers, do you think that he would take the advice of his lawyers if he's asking a question? He says, "Oh, let me answer that." That is a risk. He's opening himself up to 2.5 hours of risk.
Yeah.
If you wait to the subpoena, they say, would he dare subpoena the president? And the indication is that he might dare to subpoena the president. But then you could also invoke the Fifth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you invoke the Fifth, at least this is the argument that's being made. If you invoke the Fifth and defy a subpoena, that might get tied up in the courts long enough mm-hmm. that it could make the issue moot. Or the Supreme Court would have to decide. And I don't know if you think, I don't know if a conservative, if you think that you got 5 votes on the Supreme Court, that's worth a risk or not.
Yeah.
But the idea is you have to balance that. Even if he can get away with that, politically, is that tenable?
Mm-hmm.
If we have a president taking the Fifth on something as serious as possible collusion or possible obstruction of justice, that might not sit well politically. And they may feel like maybe we can like do halvesies, you know, give you 2.5 hours of what you want, and then we'll be protected from anything else.
Right, but the blood in the water is not collusion. The blood in the water is possibly finance campaign violations with checks given to an attorney, which was then given to a porn star.
Okay, that's a very small issue. He would not be just subpoenaed on that. He'd be subpoenaed on the Russia investigation.
Yeah.
But right now they say, yeah, that he's in most legal jeopardy,
right,
just because we haven't seen any evidence, whether there is some or not, we don't know. But the only evidence we now have of possible problems, is with campaign finance vis-a-vis Stormy Daniels.
So Rudy was asked about that, whether or not, here it is, this is the fun cut. Rudy is asked about when Trump knew about the Stormy Daniels payment.
So the president did know about this after the campaign.
Can't say that. I mean, at some point, yes, but it could have been recently. It could have been a while back. Those are the facts that we're still working on, and that, you know, maybe in a little bit of dispute. This is more rumor than it is anything else.
But that's what you said. You said that to BuzzFeed.
But here's the I mean, that's one of the possibilities and one of the rumors. The reality is,
you stated it as fact.
Well, maybe I did, but right now I'm at the point where I'm learning, and I can't prove that. I can just say it's rumor. I could prove it's rumor, but I can't prove it's fact.
Wow. He's at the point where he's learning.
Yes. When he is the attorney, the president's lawyer, and he's going on TV, national TV. He should know what he knows and say what he knows instead of dancing around. He did. You know, the first rule of doctors is first do no harm.
Yeah.
That's also what your defense attorney should be. And he's done nothing but muddy the waters and make things worse.
How could they possibly? I mean, how much money would you need to be paid to get on those shows and do that sort of thing? Did you walk off that set and go, I think that went well?
I think he does.